You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, September 6, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's Casual Friday, folks. Happy New Year if you're Jewish. If you're not, you'll just have to wait another couple of months. Sorry. All in the program today. It's Casual Friday as we start the year. What is it? 5774? Cliff Schechter will be joining us. And for our movie pick of the week, David Wayne, the director of Wet Hot American Summer, Wayne Days, Role Models, formerly of the States, will be joining us also on the program today. Syria. Barrett Brown now has a gag order. Cannot speak from a jail cell of his case. John McCain joins the Department of Justice saying, "Yeah, man, yeah, we're on the route to legalizing pot." We'll get to that story about your paid vacation is worse than that of a peasant. And the wealthy in New York speak, ladies and gentlemen. Wham. If Bill de Blasio becomes mayor, I may have to spend hundreds of dollars of more on taxes to make sure that people have pre-K. The Pope Francis continues to be a very nice guy, a mensch, if you will. And a new jobs report out today. Fairly mixed. We've got a lot of people who have left the job force 5 years out from the near anniversary of the Lehman crash, which was the sort of the harbinger, if not the beginning of the financial crisis. We have been failed. With our policy leaders of both parties and our elite have failed and have caused a tremendous amount of misery in this country. But let's we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Cliff Schechter and be talking about the misery that exists in Syria and whether or not we will contribute to it in some fashion. We'll be right back after this.
Last night.
We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone to usher in the Jewish New Year. 5774 is Cliff Schechter, but for the not quite the 5,774th time, let's play the Cliff Schechter theme song.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
We are back on the phone. It is, of course, the great Cliff Schechter. Hello, Cliff. Happy New Year.
Why, you too, Samuel. How are you?
I am well. It is the year 5774, time marches on, I guess.
Are you rejecting the Christian calendar that rules us?
I have always done that, of course, yes.
Are you some kind of Muslim or something?
Yeah, today is not. Indeed. Did you notice, I mean, you know, we'll talk to this, and obviously we're going to spend some time talking about Syria. It is the... it is the biggest ongoing story of the week and probably going forward as well. And not wholly unrelated, the new, I guess, president, I think that's fair to say, of Iran, Hussein, right? What is it? Hassan.
Rohan Hassani.
Tweeted out a happy New Year, happy Rosh Hashanah, which, you know, it's a nice, it's...
Very nice sentiment, I think.
It's a very nice sentiment. There was actually an interesting exchange. I'm trying to see if I can find it now. But,
are you looking at the Pelosi back and forth?
Yes.
Him?
So Zarif, who I guess is the foreign minister, then followed up with his own Rosh Hashanah well wishes. And Christine Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi's daughter, tweeted back, "Will you stop denying the Holocaust?" And Zarif wrote back, in what was like, I guess, his third or fourth tweet. Look, you know, Iran never denied anything. The denial was issued by a guy who is now no longer part of the government. Happy New Year. And I think it was actually even the tone was even nicer than that. So it's a new day is dawning, though not really.
It's a shame because every time they say things like that, they look a little bit less bombable.
Yes, indeed. And that is
that's very upsetting to me.
Well, you know, we have an exchange that we're going to play later in the program. Where a constituent says to John McCain, like, we didn't send you to Washington to start another war, which, you know, is probably, I don't know if there's a...
In John McCain's defense, he's made it very clear for a while now that he wants not just another war, but about another, let's call it a baker's dozen.
Exactly. I don't know if there's a single senator that you could actually look in the eye and say... we didn't send you to Washington to start another war and be as wrong as, you know, in that argument, you got to say, yeah, McCain, he's got a point. In fact, you did. If you didn't, I mean, you know, what
if you
do
voted
I do?
For McCain, you sent him back to start another war. That's really one of the few things he's good at.
Right. Indeed. I mean, bomb. Right. And all right.
He's
but
good
let's.
At, he's good at poker, the video game kind on his phone.
Exactly.
He's good at bombing stuff. And calling his wife very bad names. That's pretty much his roundup of what John McCain's done.
And it's you got it straight from the horse's mouth, folks. The author of The Real McCain, ladies and gentlemen, Cliff Schechter. All right, so let's get into what's happening now with Syria. And, you know, we've spoken quite a bit about Syria this past week on this program. We have not spoken as much about the sort of the political aspects of it, and so you know we're gonna talk a bit about that with you. piece out today in Politico, which jibes with just about everybody else's reporting and whip counts and everybody I have spoken to who hang out in Washington, and that as of now, it appears that the authorization for use of military force will pass in the Senate probably, but it doesn't look like it has much of a chance in the House.
Yeah, which not, and frankly, I guess they can put together 65, 70 votes because they need 60 in the Senate, right? I mean,
right.
I think Rand is going to filibuster it, isn't he? So,
indeed. Well, I don't know if he said he's going to filibuster it at this point. I think he said something to the effect of we're going to let this die in the House. Nevertheless, they need 60. There's a belief that they need 60.
Right. And so I guess in the end, yeah, I mean, look, McCain can bring along Lindsey and I'm sure Ayotte and people like that. And the question is how many progressives will peel off from the Democratic side, which I find interesting. But yeah, it does. It looks like, I think you're right. I think they're probably getting either close or above 60 in the Senate, but the House, I don't know how they do that, because there are enough Democrats who've already said they don't want to do it in the House. And you have to figure most of the Republicans, are not going to go along with it because, it's not a war that George W. Bush is starting.
Yeah.
So, And again, I'm being facetious in the I oppose this action, so I suppose I should just be glad they're opposing it. But I do kind of find it a little bit funny, some of the nutbag Republicans who are saying things they're saying right now, who are just all gung-ho about Iraq. I do find that kind of interesting.
Well, I mean, I think part of it is it shows the sort of the power that Randyism has in the Republican Party today. But I want to go over what Politico reports, because we could have reported this from ABC or from other whip counts, but Republicans are looking at maybe 50 to 60 Republicans who will vote. Remember, you need to get to 217. Right now, the whip counts I've seen is they have 24 yeses or lean yeses and 217 no's or leans no. Now, there's a sense that this is going to change next week when President Obama gets back, and they're going to have he's going to meet with, I guess, either congressional leaders or even more parts of Congress to show the intelligence. But nevertheless, at this point, you have Boehner and Cantor, who have not been whipping too hard, apparently, but they are definitely for it. Pelosi also and Steny Hoyer are for it. They can only get around 115 to 130 yes votes on the Democratic side. They are not whipping very hard on this at this point. Here's one.
Let me let you finish, then we'll get into the
– No, go, go.
What powers are left among both Democratic and Republican leadership?
In terms of, no, go ahead. You make
your point. I don't think anybody, most of the Republicans anymore, care what John Boehner thinks in the
right.
House. He can whip everybody all he wants. I think he's pretty close to soon being a deposed speaker. I've even heard places and read places he's not going to run again for speaker, because I think he knows his days are coming to an end. So I don't know that they're going to be able to change any minds on that side because, look, John Boehner wants you to do it. And I wonder on the Democratic side, I don't know how widespread it is, but I have a few friends up on the Hill who I've talked to. And, the thing is that who are staffers, I'll be clear, for progressives. And I think a lot of them are just kind of sick and tired of carrying Obama's water.
Interesting.
What's the, at this point, kind of what's your motivation on this?
Right.
Do it for your president, who is basically setting you up to get crushed in 2014 by Republicans who will now be able to run to your left as isolationists, because 80% of the country opposes this thing. Particularly if anything goes wrong, which nothing ever does, with
right.
these things, just ask, Jimmy Carter or George W. Bush. whether it's a limited invasion or a limited strike or a major one, and whether it's a justified one or not, war at its best is chaos. Things go wrong. There's friendly fire. Civilians get killed, and things are going to happen. And so, I'm not sure You know, before, earlier on in President Obama's term, there might have been a motivation. The party's going to help you, and there's things that could dangle in front of you. What can they dangle in front of you at this point?
Right. I mean, I think there's
this guy dragging you down and ending your career for what?
And I don't know that, that frankly, the dynamics on this are really terribly different than anything else that might expose congressional Democrats to congressional Democrats who are facing a tough re-election. If they're willing to do that for President Obama on any number of issues. And all the reporting now that I have seen is that the president will not go forward without congressional approval. It's a little bit less clear what that means in terms of if the Senate says okay and the House doesn't. But from what I've read, that unless the House votes yes, he will not go forward. I don't know how much stock we can put into that. But here's one argument that I want to talk to you about, because I have been completely mystified about this. And it is summed up in the Politico, but I see this everywhere. It's written over and over and over again. The loss, okay, so failure for Obama and once again prove that his sway over Congress is extraordinarily limited. The loss would have serious reverberations throughout the next 3 months when Obama faces off against Congress in a series of high-stake fiscal battles. Now, there's a piece by Peter Baker in the Times that talks about the implications for things like a potential strike on Iran, and we'll get to that. But can you, for a moment, explain to me how the logic of this statement? I mean, I have seen, as much as I think there is a weak argument behind the idea of sending a message, and if we don't send a message, then certain things are going to happen. At least on some level, I can see it as a very rudimentary, I think unsophisticated and wrong argument. I don't even hear anybody saying anything other than it is just the case that if he loses this vote, somehow his presidency is over and he loses all sway. I don't get how that happens.
What, how he loses his vote or how
No, like how the loss would have serious reverberations throughout the next 3 months when Obama faces off against Congress in a series of high-stake fiscal battles. How does losing a vote to strike Syria in any way implicate the battles that we're going to see in terms of shutting down the government because of the debt ceiling, or not, passing any type of continuing resolution on the budget? How does it implicate that? I mean, the analogy, it seems to me, is, hey, you can't shoot free throws, so we're not going to pick you to play on our hockey team. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think it's they're looking at more of like how Washington runs sometimes on momentum, on the sort of who's up, who's down, and how that's all kind of exaggerated by people like Politico. So that, you know, the people on the right who maybe thought they weren't going to be able to shut down the government, they're threatening to do over Obamacare. Everybody was saying, even many Republicans, conservative Republicans, Richard Burr and Tom Coburn, people were saying, well, you're crazy. And by the way, being called crazy by Tom Coburn really says something about you. That they may now become more emboldened and ask for more and threaten more. But I know what you're saying. Look, in the end, I think this is another thing that pisses progressives off more at Obama. But in the end, we want what we want. And so people are going to fight for what they're going to fight for in any of these bills, for food stamps to not be destroyed and everything else, no matter what. And people on the right are pretty much going to try and destroy everything that President Obama does, pretty much, no matter what. Those two dynamics won't really change very much. So does he lose? Do his numbers go down? And does that mean that so-called moderate, or let's call them corporatist Democrats, abandon them? I don't know. I guess it's possible if they start fearing for their reelection that they need to be bigger hawks on the deficit. I guess that's one way it could happen. I don't know how else.
Yeah,
frankly,
I mean, but I hear
about all the different moving pieces there.
I hear Democrats on, you know, on MSNBC sort of repeating this mantra, like this will leave President Obama really weak going into these budget discussions. Well, it doesn't make any sense to me at all. There doesn't seem to be even, I don't even hear anybody explaining the mechanics behind that. I mean, in what way does this leave him? I mean, which is not to say that, frankly, I mean, I don't, you know, I don't even know.
I think he's already pretty weak going into these discussions.
Indeed. And I don't know, frankly, if I want him strong or weak, depending on what he's willing to do at any given point.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, that's the biggest problem of all, is that we can't even line up behind this guy and say we know that we're for what he's going to do, because we don't know what the hell he's going to do. You know, maybe CPI will, you know, change CPI will be back on the table. Who knows? We never know. So that's why it's kind of hard to know, you know, if he's stronger or weaker, if you want to be stronger or weaker. But again, the part of that analysis that maybe makes some sense, yeah, I could see it turning some people from the more corporatist wing of the Democratic Party against him and not wanting to be associated with him in anything he does. And maybe they'll embrace more of the fix the debt stuff. That's possible. I could see that as an outgrowth of this. But, you know, right away you've got a recalcitrant, you know, group of people on the far right who are a bunch of children in the playground who, you know, want everything they want and want to do stupid things that don't work in the real world and will not cooperate in any single way because that's considered to be treason among their own. So that was going to be very difficult to manage to begin with. And the fact that President Obama and his people have never, ever, ever understood this simple concept that these people are not going to agree with him on anything and not going to work with him on anything, makes it worse because he often allows them to define the terms because he thinks, well, I'll meet them halfway, as if they would ever meet him, you know, one-tenth of the way. So, you know, as usual, I don't know that I see any of those dynamics changing.
Yeah, and then frankly, it's like, okay, if you know, I'm reading this Peter Baker piece, which talks about, and this at least makes, I mean, from a mechanical standpoint, it makes sense to me, where he writes that there's a real sense in, he writes this, in private, Mr. Obama and his team see the votes as a guidepost for the rest of his presidency beyond the immediate question of launching missiles in Syrian military targets. If Congress does not support a relatively modest action in response to a chemical attack that killed more than 1,400 people in Syria, now, I'm just reading here, folks. I don't know, you know, I'm stipulating all this stuff for the sake of this point. Obama advisor said the president will not be able to count on support for virtually any use of force. I'm not terribly concerned if this makes an attack on Iran that much harder, frankly. And if someone has an argument to me that, like, hey, if President Obama can't convince the House to vote to attack Syria, then there's less of a chance he's going to be able to push through Larry Summers as chair of the Fed. Okay. You know, it's like, I don't even understand
well,
the arguments
again,
that are being made.
I don't think, as you're saying, there's a specific, you can't do A, you can't do B dynamic. I do think that losing the vote or the Syria vote does make him look weakened. It may hurt his poll numbers, may lead some people who could have been there and been willing to kind of go with him in swing districts to walk away on the Democratic side. I can see ways it hurts him. I don't know. I think you're right. I think it's a bit of an overwrought analysis. The bigger problem, I think, is you're now taking time on this when you should be, because the Obama people don't ever seem to understand public relations and need to be out there talking about things and pushing your message, and instead they're pushing stuff on Syria right now, and so this thing's being pushed back a couple weeks, and I think it may make it harder in that way just for them to make their case. But it was always going to be really hard anyhow. I mean, we're in those times right now. We're dealing with a bunch of loons in Congress, and we will be. But I will say this. I definitely think the push on Syria, you know, in a way, I mean, let's face it, if they authorize it and we go in some form, and anything goes wrong, which, as I was saying, easily can, you know, I mean, he's throwing a big wild card into the 2014 election. So let me be very clear. Obviously, I'm only doing a political analysis right now.
Right, exactly. Yes,
from
we need to.
From the policy side, I completely disagree with it, and we could go on for a while about limited strikes by nature, if they're just limited, aren't going to do anything unless you can get this guy's. If you could get the guy's chemical stockpiles or something like that, then there could potentially be an argument. We won't. We don't know where they are. You know, if
we've already, we've already publicly said that we wouldn't even go after them because, you know, the problem with blowing up chemical munitions is that chemicals go everywhere.
Go in the air. Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if any. You're right. Some sort of a force would then have to be sent in, and that's a whole other conversation. But you know, what's the objective? With the question being, what the hell is the objective there? And you know, is on the policy side of the objective. It sounds a lot like it's just like you're slapping the guy's hand and saying you were bad. You know, we're going to drop a couple bombs on you because I'm not sure what else the objective is. It's not going to degrade him in any real way. It's not going to, I mean, they're talking about, you know, I mean, you know, if you want to protect people, then perhaps a multinational, if we could get, if, you know, maybe we could have done this if we weren't talking about airstrikes, but just a sort of a no-fly zone like what we had in Iraq before we like the dumbasses we were, we went in there. Maybe something like that could have, there, you know, there are things we could do. If we would actually, you know, join the International Criminal Court, maybe we could push for a case there, but we don't join that because we've got a couple guys in our own country here, like the waterboard people who are scared they might end up there. So it's sort of, there are options. There's freezing Syrian assets. I mean, there's all sorts of things you can do. But in the end, limited bombing, which can lead to more civilians dying, motivating more people to want to come and kill us, leading Hezbollah to be even more motivated to attack us. There's so many things that can go wrong, and yet I don't see in any way how a few attacks dissuades Assad's side, considering he knows that if the other side wins, they're going to frickin' what happened to Saddam Hussein. He will be executed, and he'll probably end up on a phone video somewhere with people mocking him as they walk him in to execute him.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much about this that doesn't make any sense, or there's so much that's not being discussed. Now, Marcy Wheeler has a great piece that she posted yesterday arguing that the administration's real agenda here, and it's reflected also in the Senate markup of the authorization for use of military force, is regime change. And there is a stated policy that that the U.S. wants Assad to go. But, you know, the problem with this is that it is unclear, like, nobody's talking about what happens afterwards. I mean, nobody's, there's just no. It
Where does that sound familiar from?
Well, I mean, aside
I can't think. It's like just the flowers that will be tossed at us in the street. I mean, I don't get, again, I mean, the guys that are going to make money off of this, you know, the munitions guys and all the rest, I get why they're in favor of it. They're amoral, scary people, but I get why they want to do it. But these neocons that never learned their lesson, what do they think it is that we could have done to make Iraq have turned out any differently? I'd like to know. You know, the blowback, every single thing we've done in the Middle East the last 50 years has had blowback that has negatively affected us from when we installed the Shah in whatever, 1953, 1954. I mean, you know, every time we meddle there, we cause, I mean, you know, or really, really almost anywhere beyond the Middle East and any Muslim countries. I mean, you know, we armed and helped, and it was a great cause and wonderful kicking the Russians out of Afghanistan. Well, that worked out well for us, arming bin Laden and his friends and training them. I mean, at what point is this just all absurd, not to mention arming Iraq the way we did in the 80s and using banks and others to launder money and send it to them and you know, agricultural subsidies, quote-unquote, and the rest, to arm them against Iran, which led them to then poison gas. I mean, I'm just so tired of all this. We're sitting here, we're watching, basically, most people probably haven't even heard of Myanmar or Burma, whichever you'd like to call it, where people are being slaughtered all the time.
Right.
Well, but we're not doing anything there. I mean, I was just reading an article about the Hindus, their extremists marching through Muslim villages and chopping people up with machetes. Not a much more pleasant way to go, by the way, than poison gas. Where are we on getting involved there?
I still contend that if you were to ask these neocons about Iraq, they would still count this as a victory. And I'm not convinced that from their perspective, it's it's wholly irrational. I think their perspective is also one of being sociopathic in many respects,
two-bit tyrant to strengthen Iran, country that they're more scared of. That was a good move.
That's just part of the program. That's just, we haven't gone far enough yet. We just haven't finished the meal.
The program. We haven't actually just turned the whole place into a glass factory. Is that essentially their view?
We now have a massive presence in Baghdad, in the Greens, you know, in the Emerald City or whatever it is. We still have this beachhead there from their perspective. I think the hundreds of thousands of people who were killed, the cost to this country, I still think from their perspective, yeah, it's worth it. I mean, I think that's one of the benefits of being a sociopath, is that the downsides seem a lot less.
You don't have trouble with those weird feelings like guilt and compassion.
And, well, you just see the world in a very different way, and we have access. They may not be pumping oil there, but we've certainly made sure that the Chinese haven't made inroads into that oil. And I think from that perspective, they would still say, on balance, Iraq is a victory. And then, of course, we need, 15, 20 years to see if this turns out to be a tourist destination for Americans, somewhere down the road. I mean, I think this is, why.
I got to be honest with you. I'm kind of excited for Kirk Disney.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think this is the only way that you guys like this coming on the television is still, talking as if they haven't been completely disgraced. And so, I think it's just sort of, it's stunning. And look, this is not to diminish. And I think there is an argument, at least in some type of vacuum, that chemical warfare is especially abhorrent because it is just aimed at civilians. I also think it's something that is easy for the international community to say, we don't want the use of chemical weapons, because there's an acknowledgement that it's also a poor military weapon in terms of if you're actually trying to win a war, as opposed to, put down a rebellion or kill civilians.
Well, look, I agree. Don't get me wrong. I think chemical weapons are terrible, but we've used them and do use them.
Indeed.
White phosphorus and napalm. And I mean, and so have our allies, and so have numerous other countries. So this just reminds me again of like the hypocrisy of where we closed off everywhere and locked everybody in a room on Iraq and made everybody forget that we'd supported them in the past, we'd armed them, and it was all, this guy used chemical weapons, as if anybody, not to say it's not a terrible thing, it is a terrible thing, but as I was just saying about Burma, there's lots of terrible things going on in lots of other places in the world. We didn't get involved in Mali, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, we go on and on about there's a whole lot of places where people have been slaughtered that we've not gotten involved in. So here there's chemical weapons, but some of that at least is still left over from a time, World War One, when we, where we decided that these things were beyond the pale. And there are a lot of things since then that haven't been banned that are also beyond the pale, that are out there being used, regularly. And I know I agree with you about
our white phosphorus. I have to say, though, it's blessed
by
God.
Random bombings don't kill civilians. I mean.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yes, I mean, the hypocrisy that I think is sort of, and people should understand as we're talking about this, that, the hypocrisy is baked into the cake. I'm not forgiving it. I'm also just sort of, it's hypocritical. And
did you see the piece in the New York Times again about, not that I didn't know this already and that you didn't know this, because we know who, kind of like in Libya and all these other places, we know who often the rebel forces are made up of. But did you see sort of the article in the Times about what these guys are? I mean,
we're talking, there was a video that accompanied that of rebel forces basically summarily executing some Syrian soldiers. One of the arguments that we're hearing from the administration is that we've done a much better job in sort of sorting out who's who over there. And so when we give aid, in June, I think it was, of this year, the president started authorizing basically providing lethal, I don't know what the exact phrasing is, but lethal weapons capacity to the rebels. And we supposedly have started to sort out who are the good rebels and who are the bad rebels. But, you know, inevitably, when you create a failed state and you create a power vacuum, those who are the worst actors tend to come out on top. I mean, sadly,
those that don't respect any norms, or I mean, you know, the Alawites, which is what the Saad family are a minority there. They're a break-off sect from the Shiites, and they're going to be if hardcore radical Al Qaeda like Sunnis take over there, they will be massacred very clearly.
Yeah, it's going to right exactly. I mean, we're going to destabilize the whole area, and then the question becomes like, you know, the only sort of extant question is this all a way in which to get Russia to begin to pressure for some type of, if not regime change, some type of cosmetic regime change in Syria that leads at least to some type of negotiated, if not end to the internal conflict, a sort of dampening down of it in some way. It's tough to get a take on this, and it sort of doesn't. It's sort of a fool's errand to try and assess what the administration's, you know, sort of real sort of agenda is here, because they seem all over the place.
Well, I mean, again, and then so we jumped off of the politics to the policy, which is obviously important. But to go back to the politics of it, what if what we do does in some way weaken Assad enough, which I don't think it will, so that some of these groups do take over, and then there's a mass slaughter of Shia and Alawites and other groups by Sunnis, and that's on their hands. And then, I mean, what we're doing here, quite frankly, in this country, is we're setting up a lunatic isolationist like Rand Paul or Ted Cruz to become the next president. Because somebody like that will run on a very populist isolationist bent that wouldn't have worked in the way they would like it to in the past, but now might work. Whether it's Hillary Clinton who served in this administration, or it's any other Democrat who they'll just tie to a failed action, or an action that, as Ted Cruz has already said out loud, you know, that President Obama, that we shouldn't be Al-Qaeda's air force in there fighting for them. I mean, we've seen this rhetoric on the other side for the people who didn't want to go into Iraq. You were helping Al-Qaeda. You think these guys won't do the opposite?
Yeah,
now?
I got to tell you.
And the difference is they'll actually be right this time,
potentially. I think the electoral implications of all of this are greatly overstated. I mean, on all sides. I mean, the reality is that the American people could barely get moved about a prolonged war in Iraq that was quite clear by 2004 and certainly by 2008 that we had been lied into. And they still, I don't think it was at the top of their list. I mean, maybe in the Democratic primary it was important, but I don't think, you know, frankly, if there's more atrocity over there or less atrocity over there, I mean, let me just preface this by saying to people before they send me emails about that I'm being cold-hearted, I'm not making that analysis right now. I'm just talking in terms about the implications of politics that, this may have more implications in a Republican primary, but in terms of general elections and whatnot, I just don't think that the American public is, frankly, that moved to their discredit, I should say. That moved
I disagree with you somewhat. I honestly think that the 2004 election, which was the closest reelection that any two-term president ever had, where Bush really barely beat Kerry, and they brought out every stop possible to do it. They suppressed every vote they could and the rest. I think that at that point Bush was severely damaged by what was going on in Iraq and what was in the headlines every day. And I think the 2006 election, where the Democrats took back the House, a lot of Democrats were running on Iraq eventually. Initially they were following the dumb DCCC advice not to, but they started seeing and doing it. When they started seeing it was a powerful issue in some of the special elections. I mean, I don't know.
I would agree.
Syria may never get that big.
I would agree that in 2006 that Democrats ran against Iraq, and that you're talking about an off-year election that motivated their base. But I just don't see. I mean, I think if we you know, I don't see this as going as being as much of a motivating factor, at least in terms of, I mean, perhaps in 14 it may have something to do with some marginal House races, but it's possible, I guess, if it turned out, but I just don't see it as having that much of an implication. It's true, Bush losses supposedly won that re-election in a closer margin than most second-term presidents, but he also didn't even win his first election, which also made him sort of a unique president to be sitting as an incumbent
well,
at that
it's
point.
True. I mean, he was a particularly weak president. I mean, I'm not saying definitively. I think it has more impact than you're giving it credit for. I'm not saying it necessarily will make a difference. I think it might, and certainly in some districts, which could make a difference. Look, every House race counts, especially when you don't have the House. And there's some swing districts where we could make some inroads with the economy improving, even right, slower than we'd like, but improving and the rest. But, I think that this complicates that. This gives them an issue to hit Democrats over the head with. And again, I agree with you that unless something goes really wrong, but if you sort of compound this, I think people are war weary after Afghanistan and Iraq and everything. Compound all that with Syria and some stuff goes seriously wrong in Syria, I'm not saying it's definitive, but if it gives any opening to a lunatic like Cruz or Paul, that frightens me. Because I don't see how either of those guys become president any other way.
Yeah, I'm not as concerned with that, but I do think, and I also think, I mean, you know, along those lines, we just got to wrap it up. We only had 2 or 3 minutes here, but I think that 130 or 115 number that we hear about Democrats willing to vote for in the House, I think as that vote approaches, if it's clear that it's not going to pass, you're going to see a lot less Democrats vote for it. Because why would you put yourself out there as voting for something unless you're fairly secure that you know is not going to? And so I think that number, that number could be much higher in my estimation. The Republicans who are planning to vote for it, I think, are doing so because that's probably their profile in their district. But I would imagine we're going to see even less numbers. But now, just so that people understand, what we're looking at is probably sometime next week we're going to see a vote in the Senate. It could stretch into the week after, but unlikely. And then probably the following week we may see a vote in the House. So we still got another couple of weeks to find out where that's going to go. And then we still don't even know what's going to happen after that, because you can't, you know, just because you're not authorizing a military strike doesn't mean you walk away from this situation.
Right. 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 I mean, then what's the follow up from that? I mean, that's exactly right.
I think sadly we're going to be waiting for some greater atrocity.
Where does it go from there? I don't know.
Yeah.
Man, I don't know. I think it could go in a lot of different directions. I think we've added a lot of sort of uncertainty into this. And again, don't get me wrong, that's a political analysis. And if this was something where I thought was a policy that could help people and was a sound policy, then it's worth whatever political whatever the political suffering is.
Yes, but you would have a lot less political suffering if there was a sound policy behind it, because then people would be making an argument for it. But the arguments we're hearing now are like, this is a Munich moment? Are you serious?
Assad, John now, Kerry should just be embarrassed, frankly.
I mean, unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I mean, you know, we've really seen the bookends of that guy's career now. I mean, his career started by asking who the last person would be to die in an unjust war, and his career is now ending on, you know, Munich comparisons, when the whole reason, one of the main reasons, that as it was dubbed, that we went into Vietnam was the so-called Munich syndrome of not wanting to have another Munich, you know, moment. And here we are. I mean, I wonder if he ever looks at his own career with any irony.
Does
quite
anybody,
frankly, give me a break.
Is there anybody, I mean, short of probably Bill Kristof, who really believes that Assad, if we don't stop him now, is going to go on some type of like international rampage with chemical warfare? I mean, the logic that he will see, like, if we don't strike him now, he's just going to do it the next time. I think that, you know, that even, you know, and look, and we just, I get a minute here because we got another guest come, but the idea, like, it's fairly clear to me that this chemical attack did not come from the rebels. But it's not clear to me that Assad is in control of his military and his government enough that this couldn't have happened from other forces within Syria. And
right.
it could be a rogue general. It could be not a rogue general. It could be a group of general. I mean, there's all sorts of different things. If you think that Assad would, there's a lesson to be learned by Assad if we strike him now, then you got to really think that he's a total idiot to have made this miscalculation for the sake of killing 1,500 people in a conflict that has already taken 100,000 lives. I don't know. There's a whole lot of this that doesn't add up.
That's the thing. There's a whole lot of rhetoric that doesn't add up, and there's a whole lot of policy outcomes that don't add up from doing this. And I just, again, I don't get it. And I will say quickly, if there are non-violent policies, that can work. From the ICC to not work, but weaken them. If there was something I believe could work, as I said, if there was, a no-fly zone instituted by a number of countries, we can get the Arab League involved in NATO. If there was, and I would say right now that if we had clear intelligence of the very clear kind, not the BS kind, that you've got one group of people marching another group of people about to commit a genocide, then yes, I would support some sort of a limited action to destroy those particular people. But to get involved when anti-aircraft missiles are hidden in cities and where we don't, you don't know which side is which and who is what, and we don't even know who we're helping, although I suspect we do know who we're helping, bad people that are really no better than Assad, then I just, I feel terrible about civilian deaths. I would do anything to prevent them. That doesn't mean that there is an answer just because you'd like there to be one.
Indeed. Great place to finish. Cliff Schechter, as always, a pleasure. Just a tragic topic to talk about on some level, and hopefully we don't increase the tragedy. We'll talk to you next week.
The rest of this day is casual Friday.
Indeed. Cliff Schechter, everybody. Thanks again, Cliff.
Thanks, buddy.
All right. We got to take a break, folks. When we come back, we're going to be talking, changing gears, I should tell you, to talk to David Wayne, who will give us a movie pick. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Good time to ask if anybody out there is good with a soundboard. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program for the first time David Wayne, the director of the cult classic Wet Hot American Summer, of Role Models, Wanderlust, Wayney Days Online. He's directed some children's hospitals. He's written about 5,000 scripts. He was one of the, I don't know if it's fair to call you the leader of the state. Were you one of the leaders of the state, David?
We were all a group together, the state we formed when we were in college.
All right. You don't have to be shy about that. I mean, there was a sense that you were one of the leaders.
The first thing on my resume, though, is it says one-time guest on the Majority Report.
Really?
Yeah, I just changed it a second ago.
Oh, I love that. I appreciate that. Now, I wanted to. It's been years, I think, since we've spoken.
I know.
I don't know why you've been.
I consider you an old friend, but I wish we saw each other more often.
Yes, my understanding is you're about to move to L.A. But before we get to that, I just want to clear something up. When you were trying to make Wet Hot American Summer.
Yes.
I advised you at that time, do not shoot this thing on film. Do not shoot it on film. I had finished Who's the Caboose. I had shot on video. And I really made it clear to you, shoot the thing on video. And I know how much it just kills you to this day that you screwed up by shooting on
film. I have to tell you, the whole impetus, the first idea of doing Wet Hot American Summer was inspired by you and the movie you made, Who's the Caboose. And we said, let's forget this bigger idea we have. Let's take a movie with all our friends and run around and take an outline and don't write a whole script and shoot it. And we even used the verb, let's Sam Cedar it.
Did you really?
And then you just amended it to mean, because we couldn't figure it out. And we didn't get the money together. It took 3 years and it evolved into more of a regular movie.
Right. And obviously much to your detriment. I mean, here you are, you're in a sound mixing studio. It obviously has not worked out for you.
It all worked out.
Oh, it did work out. Oh.
Although the movie was a huge bomb.
What happened with Wet Hot American Summer was exactly what I wanted to happen with Who's the Caboose, but did not.
Maybe it will.
10 years, maybe not.
Probably not.
But 10 years later, the thing was getting more hype and publicity than it did when it got released.
I completely agree. It's been talked about more this past summer than it ever did in the first 3 years it was out. Somehow it's this growing thing. I don't understand it. I love it. It's amazing.
And I also got to say that you guys, and now you guys had a show called Stella in New York City, and you were one of the first guys who used like email blasts to get people to your shows. And at the time, I was just like, what the hell is this? And it turns out to be one of the most important tools. I mean, that was sort of, you were one of the, you were one of the sort of the pioneers in using that, because now we see comedians and such ilk using those type of devices, you know, Twitter now, it's progressed, obviously, but you started almost like that business model. I don't know that you really get enough credit for that, but who cares, because you have such success with the rest of your career.
Well, I think that, everyone says, the first web series was something or one thing or another, and the Stella shorts were a series on the web, 5 years before any of that.
Yeah, back when you would have to actually worry about licensing. I remember you worried about licensing music at that time.
Oh, yeah, worried about a million things. It was a very weird, weird time, and barely anyone could watch it because it was those postage stamp size videos that you had to have a supercomputer at home to watch, but we did it.
And so what are you working on now? You're in the middle of a sound mix.
I'm actually in a sound mix right now for Children's Hospital, because we're the current season is airing right now, every Thursday night at midnight on Adult Swim, and so we're mixing next week's show.
So if people want to know why Children's Hospital does not show up on Adult Swim next week, it's because
I've been sitting here talking to you, and the whole system's going to fall apart.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear that. I apologize. So wait, now you're moving to L.A.? What's going on? Why are you doing this?
Well, Sam, I'm a real New Yorker. I grew up in Ohio. My whole life, my dream was to live in New York. I moved there when I was 18 to go to NYU, and I've stayed in the NYU general neighborhood ever since. I'm now 44 years old. I never intended on leaving New York, but most of my work for the past 10 years has been in L.A., and now I have children. Ugh. And it just seems like if I don't want to be separated from them for most of the time, then I've got to relocate. Although now, I still don't know. I might not commit to it.
Why don't you want to be separated from them for the most of the time? I mean, I'm saying this as a parent of two children. What is it that wants you to be not separated from them most of the time?
I just read in one of the parenting books that concept. It said, like, you should say that you don't want to be separated from your children.
Right. It's not even you actually even have to do that. It's just really important to articulate it in the event that your kids
I wanted to put that into words, and I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to say it, you know, on the radio.
Oh, my pleasure.
So that it's on the record.
Yes, and, you know, with podcast technology as it is today, too, the kids will probably be able to access this, you know, years down the road. And
well, it's very possible that soundbite will go viral.
You know, without a doubt, I've already got people working it on social media as we speak.
The gawker is calling right now. The phones are lighting up on my end.
The gawker?
I don't know.
Isn't it called gawker?
Plugline.com? I don't know who the hot websites are.
The gawker? You know, I've noticed this migration. You know, your old buddy, Michael Showalter, was in my office, I guess it was a couple of months ago, shooting some pilot for a web series about people who had stayed in New York. You know, the joke was that there were very few people, comedians, who had stayed in New York of our generation. And it was sort of a mock documentary thing about how they were, forming a co-op to make a show. And then, so he comes in, he shoots it as part of the pilot. And then I hear, like, 3 weeks later, he's moving out to L.A.
I know. That was incredibly sudden and very jarring to all of us who are the New York stalwarts in our comedic community, of which you are one and I am one, that suddenly one of the real linchpins just up and moved out of nowhere.
It's also inappropriate, right? I mean, let's be honest.
And not only that, he took a job writing on a TV show. I mean, it's like times are changing.
Yeah, I guess so.
But I do think that New York could be like the next LA. I do think like all it does seem like
the
there's a lot of
LA.
Cool stuff
what
going on
mean?
There.
What do you mean?
I don't know. I just feel like there's like cool people doing cool stuff in Brooklyn all the time, and it just feels like maybe we have Louis there, and we have like some of these hip hot things are brewing, and maybe the comedy community will emigrate back at some point.
I don't know. You sound, when you say that, you sound like even older than me. You sound out of it more than I do.
I want to kill myself.
David, let's talk a little bit about, just because we have to, because ostensibly this segment, as you know, with two children, although you seem to be able to get out of the house, but I guess, you basically threaten, dad's not going to be able to make any money.
I do not make it out too much.
Right. Well, when you're not working, right, you can't leave.
Yeah. I go to work and then I come home.
And then, but you can go, you can justify going to see a movie. Kids, honey, I have to go see a movie in a theater. I'm a director of films that go into theaters. You can justify it on those grounds. I don't have that ability.
And yet you would still be surprised how few movies I do see in theaters, which is almost none.
All right. Well, so there you have it. So now you, of course, you get screeners of everything because that's the way it works. I know.
Sometimes.
I'm out of that loop now. I don't get screeners of anything.
All right.
I don't even – I could, if I'm lucky, I will get a galley of a book that's being written about Medicare policy or something like that.
I will go to the Hollywood headquarters later this afternoon and see what I can do about that.
Although I did just get a copy of Michael showing it to me right now in our studio, Before Happiness, The 5 Hidden Keys to Achieving Success, Spreading Happiness, and Sustaining Positive Change. So I got that going for me.
Okay, that's good.
But when I want to see a movie, I have to stream it on Netflix or on Amazon or iTunes now or Crackle or whatever it is that I have in my Roku.
Which is a pleasure.
It's nice. I like it. I mean, it's different than when we grew up, obviously. But I know. We at that time it was all occasionally you'd see something on UHF. So all right, here you
are. We have lost that sense of discovery, like, oh my god, this movie was on, I caught it, or I found it at the store. With no more of that.
Well, that's the problem with all our media today, isn't it?
It is, and it's really sad. You can never, like, there's no waiting around to get a record or get anything. It's just everything's always there, but I suppose it's more good than bad.
I mean, I guess that's why you like go on Pandora or something or Spotify and just say, you know, you choose for me. It's sort of like, you know, gives you a somewhat of that sort of college radio feel where you just don't know what's going
to
show
I
up.
I think we just have to accept that it's different. Times change.
Yeah, no, I can accept it. But with that said, I have on the phone someone who has directed one of the biggest cult classic comedies of the past decade. I mean,
yes.
Actually, it's even beyond a decade, which is a big deal. I mean, for me, I mean, I remember when I made Who's the Caboose. For me, all I wanted was people to be watching that movie 10, 15, 20 years later, like in the way that I watched Holy Grail or
right.
Or stuff like that. That's what I wanted. And fortunately, I send out enough copies of Caboose that I know that there's at least one person watching it. I don't know that they're enjoying it necessarily, but it's quite...
Well, you've got one fan of that movie in me that I pull it out every few years and show it to somebody.
Really?
It's so funny.
Well,
so
that's
good.
Very kind of you. But, but you know, I pick... I on the rare occasions I'm at the dentist, I pick up E or whatever... EW magazine or Entertainment Weekly or whatever it is, and there's a full price of like an 8-page spread about what Hot American Summer 10 years after the thing's been released.
It's crazy. I can only say I'm thrilled about it. What I don't know.
All right, well, you don't have to say anything else, but
all right,
I want to hear as the auteur or one of the auteurs of that film, what should I watch on Netflix or on iTunes or, you know, I mean, and it's tough because you know that I've watched a lot of the stuff that you might recommend. So now you've got to come up with something that is...
I'm going to tell you. Well, I mean, I'll tell you what I just got through, which I'm sure you've seen, is House of Cards.
Yes, I did see that. What did you think of that? I mean, look, hold on. I want to just say right now, spoiler alert, but, you know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This is the problem with TV, but I think, like, well, how long
I know, no one's at the same time, same episode at the same time.
It's been 8 months since it was released, I think, at this point, so.
I think at this point it's okay. Everyone's talking about season two already.
All right, so what did you think?
I loved it. I binged it.
Well, I know. I mean, it's designed for binged, but, all right. Tell me what you loved about it.
What's that?
What did you love about it?
Well, first of all, I loved the main character, and I loved how, you know, interesting his motivations are. I loved how his political beliefs do not play into his game at all, if he has any. It's all about the game and the power and the chess game. And I thought, for me, what put it over the top was the way he narrated to camera, the direct address, where he sort of brings me, the viewer, into his little machinations and those little looks to the lens. And then I just loved all the other characters, and I just thought it was really exciting. I'm not, like you, an expert in the machinations of politics, but I just found it to be immensely suspenseful and entertaining and thrilling and exciting.
I also enjoyed it. You know, the whole thing is the King Lear thing, right? With the I enjoyed it too, but I'll tell you where it broke down for me. And it is implicit in your praise of House of Cards, which was like the chess game. I really like stuff like that. That's why I still am one of the few people, and I am not embarrassed to say it, I still watch Survivor. I still like the chess game that's going on there, all right? But the problem is, when he took that step where he eliminated one of the players in a way that goes beyond the chess game, you know, where basically, I mean, I don't want to get too explicit here, but he basically took the board and flipped it. That,
right.
When it goes into that round,
I will concede I was bumped by that as well.
That ruined it for me, totally.
Because then it just. I think, and now I agree. That was a little bit of a really? Is that we're going there?
Right.
But now looking at it as a whole season and knowing that it's a two-season thing, I see it as like it's a Julius Caesar situation. Like, I can tell that now if you see how the season ended, everything will revolve around that crazy one event, you know?
I know, and that's cheap and it's boring. That makes it boring to me. That's why. It was much more interesting when it was just like, okay, you know, I mean, that moment for me was like, oh, the guy, you know, pulls off his shirt and he realized, oh, he's actually from Krypton. And so he's,
yeah,
you know.
I don't disagree with what you're saying, but it did not ruin it for me just all the same. But I am with you on that.
And I got to say, I had the same problem with Wanderlust.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, I thought that would
goes off the rails.
All right, so I've already seen House of Cards. So that's not going to do it.
No, that's
buddy.
Fine. I've got other. I could tell you other things. You know what I was thinking? Well, what's interesting is, as a purveyor of comedy, I don't really watch that much on Netflix and stuff because it's not. I don't want to.
But comedy doesn't generally. I mean, this is the other thing. I want not to sort of like, you know, get back and continue to blow smoke here, but the thing that's very impressive about Wet Hot American WHAS, as you guys call it,
yes,
that comedy doesn't seem to hold up generally that well. Do you find that to be the case? I mean, because comedy gets, like, even Woody Allen films for me now, maybe it's because I just watch them so much, but the comedy gets absorbed into the sort of the bloodstream, and then what was sort of like interesting and sort of different in terms of the way that it impacted the sort of the cultural language of comedy gets absorbed into it, and then it becomes less fresh. Do you experience that as well or no?
I think that the Wet Hot American Summer benefits from the fact that it was a period piece, so it didn't feel as dated.
Uh huh.
And I also think that it's just, you know, it was a sort of style of joking and humor that has become more widespread since it was made. But I would also say that it has only been 12 years, and, you know, the Woody Allen movies are in some cases 30, 40 years old.
Yes, yes. And
even those, if you go back, are, I think, many of them pretty hysterical even now.
Yeah.
You go watch Bananas or Sleeper and so on. So, who knows?
It's interesting that you mentioned the two more physical comedies, Bananas and Sleeper.
I'm just talking about things that are just straight-up hysterical, you know. But I'm a big Woody Allen fan, and I do think that his good movies do hold up.
All right. Fair enough. I mean, I wasn't talking specifically about Woody Allen, but I was just using.
A movie that I was going to recommend is not a comedy because it's actually slightly more political. But I don't know if you've seen it or remember it if you have seen it. But it's an old movie called The China Syndrome.
You know, I haven't seen it in a long time.
I think if you're our age, you might have seen it a long time ago, but don't remember it. And
yeah,
if you're younger, you probably never saw it. But it's with Jane Fonda, Michael Douglas, and Jack Lemmon, and it is a story about an accident that happens at a nuclear power plant, and it was famous at the time because it happened to be released 12 days before there was an actual accident at Three Mile Island.
Yeah, Three Mile.
But separate from that, it happens to just be one of the most exciting thrillers that you'll ever see. You're on the edge of your seat from beginning to end, and it's funny also, and it's just like a movie that I've seen 100 times.
People who are watching me now on our app or on YouTube are seeing me write it down, which, I do that every time. But that is still that's China Syndrome. That's a great suggestion. Also, not in the least, because Fukushima was in the news this week. Because that disaster is still sort of ongoing, and what now appears to be not just ongoing, but growing.
Yes, which is horrifying.
Horrifying.
Well, you'll get a sense of what the mindset was among some two sides of it in the 70s, or 1980, if you see the China Syndrome.
All right, so China Syndrome it is. What's next? Are you going to make another movie?
Well, I'm finishing a movie that I shot in New York called They Came Together, with starring Amy Poehler and Paul Rudd and Ed Helms.
It was in New York.
It was in New York. I shot in Brooklyn.
Huh. I guess I just did not get the message.
I called my email address. It rang. And
spam
I guess
guard.
You
I
went
gotta
home,
change.
And then
gotta change.
I got
this.
Your message machine, and then it sounded like the tape was maybe mangled or something. I don't know.
Tape?
On your machine?
Yeah, there's no. That's weird because I have voicemail.
Oh, huh.
It is strange.
Well, maybe, you know what it was? I think your cleaning woman answered the phone, and I told her to take a message, but she doesn't speak English, and
not
I think that's what it was.
Not a cleaning woman, no. That maybe you spoke to my daughter.
That's who it is. That's who it was.
Yeah, that was weird. All right, yeah. Well. All right, so wait. So it's in New York, and when's it coming out? Is it funny?
It's going to come out, I'm not sure the date yet, but it's going to come out sometime in the next number of months.
All right.
And it's called They Came Together.
They Came Together? Do you want to give us a little, I mean, what is it about?
It's kind of a classic romantic comedy, but
rom-com?
Almost a spoof.
A spoof on rom-coms?
Like a cuckoo, crazy, silly, purposely dumb romantic comedy.
And are you making more Wayne-y days?
I will be, although I'm not sure exactly when. And I have another series called Newsreaders that's on Adult Swim that's going to have a second season soon.
Sweet. Wow, and, so you're incredibly busy.
You know, there's stuff.
You're incredibly busy.
Down the pipeline. I have a website called davidwayne.com if people are interested.
All right, folks. Head over to davidwayne.com to get updated on all those things. And man, you're just incredibly busy, it sounds like.
I have been, although actually this summer I took 5 weeks completely off.
Oh, God. I took a little time, like an extended paternity leave.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
And congratulations on your new child.
Thank you very much.
Exciting.
Yeah, I hope he learns to take phone messages better than the first one.
I'll throw it out. Two movies I did see in the theater recently that I really did like a lot were called The Way, Way Back and In a World.
I've never even heard of those.
Oh, my God. Way, Way Back with Steve Carell and In a World with Lake Bell. Just both great.
Way Back, In a World. All right. I'll look for those to show up.
They'll be on video soon, I'm sure.
Yes. All right. Well, David Wayne, always a pleasure to reconnect.
Sam, I'm glad we got to get into it, go over the headlines as we usually do.
Yes. And hopefully I'll run into you soon, but not if you're...
I look forward to it anytime. And thanks for having me on.
All right. David Wayne, everybody. Thanks, David. All right, folks. I guess it's a freebie Friday, right? We probably had one coming.
Yeah. Mine's well.
Don't have much.
I'm not even up.
All right.
Mine's well.
We've got...
Am I up?
You're up.
All right.
I wasn't.
What's that?
The usual reversal. From
reversal,
things,
yes.
Usually are.
We've got a song from...
Got to pull that. I'll get it right.
All right. Well, wait a second. I think I can grab it here, if that's the case. Let's see. Here we go. I will play it. It is called My Kind of Country by Jimmy Reefercake. Here we go.
You heard them country music songs about lovers that you lose, or island paradises and an awful lot of booze. I prefer to sing about legalizing weed. I think that's the kind of country we need. Oh, that's not my kind of country. That's not what my music's for. It's Joe Sixpack brainwashing madness. Support the troops really meant. Support the wars. No, that's not my kind of country. I'll smoke a big fat joint. I'll strum my guitar. Yeah, my song will make a point. You'll figure out it's not that hard. No, I ain't no Kent Chesney. That's just not my kind of country. I'm proud to be an American. But we've been there already. We don't need to go there again. Awful sorry about what's happening in Syria. But I'm not believing in this war machine hysteria. No, this ain't my kind of country.
Oh, that was quite good.
Yeah, it was.
Quite good. Jimmy Reefercake says, be sure to check out Jimmy Reefercake on Facebook. Why not support Reefercake Nation and allthehypocrisy.com by purchasing a tune? Why not, folks? We'll put a link to allthehypocrisy.com on our blog. For the maximum feel-good experience, buy a tune with Music for Good, and you will donate to charitywater.org. Jimmy Reefercake coming in with a very, I think it was a
soulful.
Soulful song. All right, folks, number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the number. We're going to end up going a little bit late today, maybe. 646-257-3920. Let's check out the IMs. Apropos of Jimmy Reefercake's song, let's get to this story about the Department of Justice. It happened earlier in the week, and, of course, we just didn't get to it because of everything that's been happening with Syria. But I guess it was a week and a half ago now. Well, exactly almost 1 week ago, last Thursday. Attorney General Holder informed the governors of Washington and Colorado State, who, as you will recall, in the 2012 election referendums, essentially decriminalized and legalized marijuana. He informed them that the Department of Justice would allow the states to create a regime that would regulate and implement those ballot initiatives that legalize the use of marijuana for adults. The department would take a trust but verify approach to the state laws, which is good. I think they should probably do that with all regulations, frankly. We should do that also with environmental regulations. And how about banking and financial regulations? That would also be nice.
Don't go too far.
Right. That's getting carried away. Deputy Attorney General James Cole issued a 3.5-page memo to U.S. attorneys across the country. Now, understand the dynamic here. U.S. attorneys get guidance from the Department of Justice, but they have a certain amount of independence, which allows them to go further and sometimes not be as aggressive in terms of what they end up prosecuting, because they make a determination as to what essentially are high priority cases. Prosecutors do that all the time. It's prosecutorial discretion. So we may see some U.S. attorneys who try and grandstand and don't necessarily follow these memos. But we shall see. The Department of Guidance in this memorandum rests on its expectation that states and local governments that have enacted laws authorizing marijuana-related conduct will implement strong and effective regulatory and enforcement systems that will address the threat to those state laws could pose to public safety, public health, and other law enforcement interests. As far as I can tell, this memo makes all sorts of sense. The DOJ will still prosecute individuals or entities to prevent any of the following eight situations: the distribution of marijuana to minors, revenue from the sale of marijuana going to criminal enterprises, gangs and cartels. We should be doing this with any, frankly, revenue of any product. The diversion of marijuana from states where it's legal under state law in some form to other states. This one is going to be sort of inevitability, but we have already laws about contraband where you have like tobacco crossing states with a different sort of regulatory regime. State authorized marijuana activity from being used as a cover or pretext for the trafficking of other illegal drugs. Well and good. Violence and the use of firearms and the cultivation and distribution of marijuana. Well and good. The point of legalizing it is to take one of the points is to take it out. Well, the biggest point is, I think, in many respects, take it out of the black market, which breeds all of the problems so far that we've listed. Drug driving and the exacerbation of other adverse public health consequences associated with marijuana use. First half of that I got no problem with. The second half is a little bit vague. I'm not sure exactly what that is. Maybe, you know, you shouldn't be, I don't know, high and operating heavy machinery. That, I think, is also probably pretty wise. The growing of marijuana on public lands, indeed. We should also, while the DOJ is at it, maybe look into this fracking stuff that is also, but
be there. Again, Sam, stop going so far.
Right, let's not get too carried away. Preventing marijuana possession or use on federal property. All right, whatever. So there it is, folks. Just don't go down to the local federal building. You know, leave your nickel bag. Or, do they still sell nickel bags? Do you guys even know what I'm referring to?
Was that a $5 bag?
There you go. Not so much anymore. I guess I'm not in high school anymore.
Neither are we, unfortunately.
Oh, you wouldn't believe the nickel bags you'd get back when I was in high school. All right, let's go to the IM. Wow.
That's the most excited I've ever seen, Sam.
No, still the app. Still the app.
Yeah, I was
the
just
app.
About the app, besides the app.
Update on the app, ladies and gentlemen. We have yet to get clearance through the iTunes store, which may, you know, I want to be able to coordinate it so that we can all download it. So it may push it back a couple of days, but we'll know on Monday. We'll have a better sense of that on Monday. By minimum, me from the app, IMs, I have just had a couple of drops and have had to restart the live stream. And now it's telling me that my name is in use, so I had to change it. Interesting. I rarely get to listen live, so these issues are new to me. He's listening on 3G. Kyler's on the Majority FM app test. A square. Sam Shana Tova. Hope I got that right. You did. You're one of the few who brought up the background of the Syrian conflict, which is climate change and economic conditions. I never thought we would find ourselves here with Obama. Some of the statements are so similar to those made by the neocons from the Foreign Policy Project, which is basically PNAC Redux. Can't believe they even dragged out the Viceroy Bremer this week. Bremer, of course, was the, I think, the second Viceroy of Iraq. I think it was General
Garner, right?
Who was not with the program, apparently, of making Iraq into a free market paradise that Bremer was.
When you read about those accounts, it's fascinating that, like, the old school military and oil guys are like, no, I mean, you can't actually eliminate the entire federal government and sign away the oil rights to us. That actually isn't such a hot idea.
Yeah. Get out of here, old man. My sense is Obama is too far out there not to strike, even if Congress votes no. I don't know. I think the political damage in him striking, you know, like I say, the only benefit for President Obama to attack Syria after the House votes no would be to encourage the Republicans to impeach him, which might be the best thing that could possibly happen. Although in this case, you know, he set himself up in a way that I think it would be very difficult. He may have reserved the right to attack, but sorry, everybody knows when you ask for permission, it's always harder than trying to apologize after the fact. And you ask for permission and you are told no, even if it's a qualified, we're not really asking for permission, I'm asking for your blessing. You've created another fence, which is you've basically said, I don't care that you don't bless me now. So I think it would be very problematic. I don't think he is going to.
That's interesting. Duly noted. Go screw yourselves. Sorry.
Last night, Chris Hayes said the New York Times photo was from April 2012. Fair enough. Interesting that it's coming out now. Crystal Count. Happy Rush, banana, or whatever, Sam. I'm even happier that the media back under 100% Jew control. Hope you guys plan to fire David Gregory soon. And speaking of controlling media, no offense, MSNBCers, but can you name one big Obama initiative anyone left of Lawrence O'Donnell wants to see passed? And I mean things he'll actually fight for, not just speech up. Till it's something more progressive than cutting pillars of our once great middle class, will I'll continue to see the wackos in the House continue to be the heroes of the second term. I think, Cliff and I sort of touched on this a little bit here, which was that, like, you know, what exactly does it mean to weaken President Obama's agenda? I'm not clear on what that agenda would be. I mean, I know he's talking about climate control, but I still see Keystone XL hanging out there. It's not like this guy has expressed a really strong will to, I mean, honestly, like, am I missing something here? What part of his agenda are we supposed to?
Well, it's in the question, though. There are, like, what are the things that he's actually going to the mat for? So raising the minimum wage is great. And if he actually pushed for that significantly, that would be great. Doesn't seem like he's doing that.
That's still an issue for, but
he's college, not... college costs thing, and maybe an immigration bill, depending on how that shapes up.
Immigration, as far as I can tell, is dead in the water. He's gone as far as the mat is going to anyways on that. He didn't have the leverage to pass.
And if it's not dead, it's not due to him. That's due to other people's calculations.
Indeed. Indeed. I mean, it's a good point. I'm not saying that there isn't stuff that he might be promoting that I would want to see happen. But if you can point to me, like, if he doesn't get this vote, his initiative X, which you agree with, his chances are severely diminished from what they were before any of this came up. I can't point to something. I'm sure there might be something there, but I can't point to it.
Well, even on the climate stuff, that's where in the good things he wants to do, he has way more executive discretion
Indeed.
Over that anyways.
He already made that clear.
To do with what Congress is
already
doing.
Made that clear. Yeah. So I've touched on this briefly. I don't know that I've read this piece, and it's really important. We're going to link to it at majority.fm. I think we already did the James Fallows thing. I don't know if we did already.
Link to it now.
James Fallows has been doing a series of questions about the Syrian, about getting involved in Syria. And he posted an email that he got from William Polk, who was a State Department official in the Kennedy administration. And he, among the other things that he talks about, it's a fascinating piece. It's a long read. You should read it. But one of the things he mentions, which has, as far as I can tell, gotten no, zero media coverage in contextualizing all this. He writes, Syria has been convulsed by civil war since climate change came to Syria with a vengeance. Now, understand, we have been hearing, and we know that the Pentagon views climate change as one of the top security threats that this country faces going forward in the future. We have heard about, you know, how this may impact, domestic politics insofar as we're talking about wildfires. We're talking about more money for extreme weather, things like Sandy, Katrina. We could be losing Miami in the next 20 to 30, 40 years. The other way that this is going to affect this country, if it's not enough for you to appreciate how devastating climate change is going to be in terms of creating droughts and refugees around the world and what it may do just to our civilization writ large by the end of the century, understand that it's going to directly implicate the United States in terms of the way that about war and spending money and all of it. And this is a perfect example. Drought devastated the country from 06 to 2011. Desperate for waters, farmers began to tap aquifers with tens of thousands of new wells. But as they did, the water table quickly dropped to a level below which their pumps could lift it. In some areas, all agriculture ceased. In others, crop failures reached 75%. And generally, as much as 85% of livestock died of thirst or hunger. Hundreds of thousands of cereal farmers gave up. They abandoned their farms. They headed to the cities and towns to look for non-existent jobs, creating food shortages, creating overcrowding in the cities, creating more social pressure. Outside observers, including UN experts at the time, estimated that between 2 and 3 million of Syria's 10 million rural inhabitants were reduced to extreme poverty. Syrian domestic refugees found that they had to compete not only with for scarce food, water, and jobs, but with an already existing foreign refugee population. There's a 250,000 Palestinians and about 100,000 people who had fled the occupation of Iraq in Syria. The senior UN Food and Agricultural Organization representative in Syria at that time turned to the U.S. aid program for help, terming the situation a perfect storm. In November of 2008, he warned that Syria faced social destruction. He noted the Syrian Minister of Agriculture had stated publicly that the economic and social fallout from the drought was beyond our capacity as a country to deal with. USAID director commented that we question whether limited USG government resources should be directed toward this appeal at this time. In other words, we had no money to support that appeal. It was downgraded as a priority, and or there was political pressure to make Syria suffer. Lured by the high price of wheat on the world market, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Syria sold 1.5 million metric tons of their wheat reserves, twice that they had in 2005. The next year, it had little to left to export in 2008, and the rest of the drought years, it had to import more wheat to keep its citizens fed, obviously creating financial duress. So he refers to this as the tinderbox. And when a small group gathered in the town of Dara to protest against the government failure to help them, the whole thing exploded back in 11. And obviously, it was also part of the Arab Spring, which, you know, as we mentioned with Matt Duss, was also a function of economics. But in this case, it was economics where the situation was exacerbated by global climate change. And it's not hard to see the paradigm here that's being set up. Global climate change creates situations on the ground that destabilizes countries all around the world. We end up getting drawn into conflicts that end up being fought over the most basic of resources, food, water, shelter. So the idea that this is not being contextualized in this way is doing a great disservice to the country and to the policy it pursues in the future, because it again does not reveal what is such a massive problem now and looming in our future. So every time we hear Syria, there should be some commentator saying, how could we pass Keystone XL with this? Every time we hear Syria, somebody should be saying, how can we not be addressing climate change in our own country and using that as to send a message to the rest of the world?
In 2004, I think the Pentagon, it might have even been the CIA, they commissioned a study by a thing called the Global Business Network. And they said climate change is one of the significant security challenges.
That's why I started that little monologue. Did you not hear that part?
You mentioned that study?
No, I didn't mention the study. I said the Pentagon came out and said it was one of the top.
Global Business Network study.
Yes, I didn't mention the actual name of the study. Okay.
I missed that when I was posting it on the website. I apologize.
That's okay. Silva, I believe the fundamental difference between conventional weapons and chemical weapons is that with chemical weapons, there's a certain level of defenselessness on the part of the people that are attacked with gas. With conventional combat, there's at least a chance of an opportunity to retaliate and fight back, but no such opportunity is given with chemical weaponry. They are, of course, both equally terrible, and the loss of life is sad, but the issue to me is that chemical warfare seems to be worse because of the nature of defenseless of the victims. They never saw it coming. I mean, I think, look, I think there is definitely an argument that because of the nature of chemical weapons being used against civilians, that they are in a different class. But none of that, but that's just an opinion that we have at a bar stool. The fact that there's an international prohibition against it raises the stakes involved in the use of chemical weapons. But if the international community that passes this does not perceive the infraction to be egregious enough or to be addressable enough to warrant a response, then that's where it has to end. And then you don't have to get into the issues of hypocrisy or the issue of whether or not it's morally more or less reprehensible. I mean, you know, civilians are defenseless too when a bomb blows up around the corner from them. And they don't have, you know, some type of Patriot missile shield. You know, it's like, I think like there is a point in making a distinction with the chemical warfare, but it can go, it only serves this whole question so much, I think is what I'm saying.
And I think it's important to make a distinction with the chemical warfare. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry.
Majority Report Zach, I'm getting increasingly worried that even if the Congress disallows military action in Syria, the Obama administration will proceed anyway. This case would be a huge constitutional crisis and one that would not resolve well for anyone involved. I mean, I think there's some truth to that. John Kerry made a pretty good case for limited strikes in Syria on Chris Hayes' show last night. The thing that worried me most was Kerry's hand-wavy answer as to what would happen if Assad used weapons again after a strike. I really want to believe that we wouldn't escalate to a full-scale assault, but I don't. Also, you know, I would like to see, you know, I would like to hear if we have evidence that Assad issued this order, okay? Because I would assume that even if we have secret intelligence saying it, we could characterize it that way. I have not seen it characterized that way. It is very likely that if Assad did not issue that order, but other elements of his government did, that he would not say like, hey, I have no control of my own people right now because I have, you know, guys who are starting to think like, hey, maybe Assad won't be around that much longer. Maybe an attack would weaken him. I mean, there's all sorts of, it's very easy to come up with a scenario where, in fact, I would say much easier to come up with a logical scenario, a more obvious scenario, that elements within the Assad regime, the government or the military, perpetrated this than, say, the rebels. Because these are the people who hold the levers. These are the people who, you know, if I'm a general and the U.S. strikes, I may be in better position to move up in the ranks if it goes the way that the United States wants it to. I mean, there's all sorts of machinations here that could be happening. So we don't know. And, you know, my point in raising this is that if the calculation is we send a message to Assad and he doesn't do this again because he knows what will happen, he will get thrown out, it implies that Assad has full control over what's going on there. And I don't know that that's the case. And I haven't seen anybody even sort of question that. So I would like, you know, I would have liked to have seen a question by Hayes in that exchange, which went something to the effect of, do you have intel that says Assad is in complete control of this chemical arsenal? Do you have intel that says that he necessarily directed this attack? I know you said the Assad regime has done it. Do you worry that he doesn't have full control over it? We're already starting to see generals defect. It's weird that we don't hear. Maybe it was brought up in the hearings. I didn't hear it in the hearings. And it seems to me a question that should be asked here. It's a far more likely scenario, it seems to me.
You than think the, it's far more likely?
Than the rebels?
Oh, it's certainly than the rebels. But, like, within the government, that far more likely?
I'm not an expert on this stuff. But, it, you know, we, just in the same way that we think it's a childish calculation to say, we're going to send a message to Assad, and he's going to only think about the message we're sending as opposed to all the other dynamics that are going around. We also have to remember that these regimes aren't always cohesive in and of themselves, but in a crisis, they and where people start to see opportunities or start to see liabilities, these things start to fracture in many different ways. And, you know, there was a lot of question of, like, why would Assad do this with weapons inspectors on the ground? You know, maybe it was that there was that much of a threat coming from that sector of where the attack happened, and they wanted to make it sort of, you know, radioactive, metaphorically. But maybe it was also because someone else in the regime saw an opportunity to create a showdown like this, which would, in their calculation, behoove them. It's far more likely to see someone who perceives that type of calculation than one where Assad said, this is really going to be in my best interest. You know, and there's been very little discussion of that. But everybody just assumes Assad's in charge of everything. You know, I mean, it's the sort of same calculation of Putin's in charge of everything. You know, it's... We know there are fractures within the Iranian regime, right? I mean, and it's a different, and so I don't know. It just seems, it seems to be a bit of malpractice not to be asking this question about the intel. And I would like to see that question asked. Kyle, Wayne Days is great. From the app. Ooh, Kyle getting in on it. Triangle Bill from the app. Hi, Sam. Happy Friday. Everyone just wanted to say to you and Cliff made about how absurd the pro-attack rhetoric has gotten on last night's Hayes. He had on Alan Grayson and Karen Finney. Finney claimed that Democrats voting against this authorization would be, in effect, destroying the remaining time Obama has in office. I don't even know what that means, though. That's, I keep hearing that guy. I don't even know what it means. That Grayson will be making Obama a lame duck. Thoughts? Yeah, I don't even know what that means. How? I don't, like... Okay, you said that, but just give me even a sentence that explains the mechanics. He loses a vote, and on apples and all these other votes on oranges, I mean, it's as if this is the only thing that people decide to vote upon. I don't get it. I just don't get it. Also, incidentally, I rewatched Who's the Caboose and loved it as much as always. Have a great weekend. Quick plug. Move to Amend is holding a regional democracy conference in Charlotte, North Carolina this weekend. It is movetoamend.org. That is, I presume, to amend the Constitution and to have corporations not be considered people. Heather, let's go to the phones. Let's get one call in. To wind up the week, Heather from Mount Vernon, Washington.
Hey, how you doing, buddy? I'm Syria. I'm sorry I haven't been able to hear you for the last minute or so.
Okay.
But I was reading an interesting article that Zachary recommended yesterday, and it was on the Truth Out, and it suggested that several really interesting things, possible Israeli source of and the intelligence, as well as what was really kind of most interesting to me is a non-military grade weapons, the likelihood of the sarin gas being diluted or somehow not very effective based on the number of deaths compared to the number of people that were subjected to the gas and the physical symptoms that were observed, which were... Not much. What you would expect with sarin gas, I guess, according to the Truth Out article, was that you would say, and I'm sorry, I don't know about sarin gas.
No, you know, Heather, I know this piece you're talking about. It was written by Garth Porter. I actually interviewed this guy for Ring of Fire. We didn't talk, ostensibly we were going to talk about that. We ended up talking about a different a different theory he has, which is really a fascinating one. I mean, I don't know how if I subscribe to it, but he really thinks that Obama is actually not interested in this engagement, and that he's getting pushback not from the military, but from the sort of security establishment elite, including Kerry and Rice. I don't know how much I subscribe to it, but that it was an interesting theory, and we may play that actually next week. Let me just say this about that about the evidence. I think, and I don't even think he was going as far. He was just saying that there are reasons to be skeptical about the audience. I don't think that pressed, he would say that the preponderance of the evidence shows an attack by the rebels. I don't think he would say that. I think it's, look, in these situations, it's always nebulous. I just don't think, though, that based upon all the different people I have been reading, people who are skeptical of this stuff, that there is a lot of legitimate questions as to whether or not the rebels did it. I do think that what has not been addressed is what elements of the Assad regime may have ordered this, which are distinct issues here and have different and distinct implications. Nevertheless, I think the getting bogged down in those questions, particularly as to whether or not the rebels did it or not, is self-defeating, because I don't think that even if we had 100% conclusive proof that Assad himself ordered it, or, you know, went down to the battle line and said, I'm going to be the first one to fire off this rocket, that it would still justify an attack. And so I think it is better and just more relevant to argue on those terms. I think there are probably questions. I think it's really important that we are skeptical of any evidence at any time on these topics. But unless there is some type of international response, because I sort of am of the belief that when you have, you know, if you're going to attack based on international norms or an international red line, then it must be the international community that makes that determination whether or not the line's been crossed.
I think it's ridiculous that the UN ambassador even would mention international norms after the violations that we have done in the last 12 years in our involvement in that part of the country, as well as the big oil chokehold and the unwillingness for the administration or anyone.
All right, let me ask you this.
Acknowledge that we have this chokehold of Wall Street over us.
Heather, let me ask you this, okay? And this is why I don't get into the hypocrisy argument that much. Assuming, okay, and I think it's quite clear that we've used things like white phosphorus and whatnot. Assuming that this country's policy has been to engage in chemical warfare, is there ever a situation where you think that we should stop any other entity from using chemical warfare on their civilians?
I don't think that it's our job to be the world police. I think that it's our job to respect what the UN has to say and not just go it alone and decide that we are going to go solve it.
I agree on that latter point, that this is that if we're going to intervene, we need the international communities. We need we need to do it through the auspices of the UN. I also think, look, the reality is, I also think that there are instances, or at least I can imagine instances, where the Security Council is also being hypocritical by saying we should intervene in this situation. Nevertheless, I think the UN is really the best of the worst options we have in making that determination. But just because the UN is hypocritical does not mean to me that we shouldn't follow what the UN is saying at that point, because, you know, unfortunately, we live amongst human beings. So I just think the hypocrisy argument. I mean, look, I get it. The moral grandstanding is I find to be overwrought. on some level about chemical warfare as opposed to anything else. But I just don't think that that's the strongest argument as to why we shouldn't go in. And
okay, Sam, but
go ahead.
May I?
Yeah.
I really appreciate you mentioning the drought, the climate crisis, and how this initiated the problems in Syria. And so, yes, I guess based on that, based on the fact that maybe Syria is feeling the heat, you know, fastest and first, maybe would that be a basis of not intervening or just doing it in a different way and approaching the problem in a different way?
No, I think the basis for doing it in a different way is that war is not good. And that there is no scenario that I've heard anybody articulate where this works out well by us in intervening militarily in this conflict at this point. That to me is all the argument that you need. You know, Syria doesn't need to get special dispensation for gassing its own people or you know, engaging in brutality. Forget the chemical warfare. I mean, Assad is brutal. They don't get dispensation because their enemies are brutal, and they don't get dispensation because it was global climate change. This is a question in my mind of efficacy. I mean, I personally believe that when it's clear that we can stop an imminent slaughter of civilians, that we have a moral obligation to do so. And I also believe that the only way to make that determination is through the UN, because I don't think there's a better way of doing it. I do believe that we have a responsibility to be a something of a global police officer. I have a problem with us being also the global judge, too, though. And I am willing to sort of cede that authority to the UN, as imperfect of a body as it is, and operating on the aggregate of individual countries' agendas, which are certainly not pure of heart, because we don't have a better institution to do it. And I don't think that we need to raise an argument saying, you know, that there's the evidence is not airtight in this, because we're not under threat from Assad anyways. The question is do we intervene to protect civilians? And I think that in that situation, the only way that we have authority to do that is if the UN has determined that that's what needs to happen. And the UN hasn't. And so
we'll intervene to save the civilians from a drought, the social, you know, the deterioration of their strength as far as the climate crisis. We have no intention of intervening for that reason. That's humanitarian.
I agree with you. We should be doing this. I mean, if only, not just from a humanitarian standpoint, but from our own national interests. But so, I mean, I would like to see us intervene with more aid, both pressure like the Arab League to provide more aid for refugees. I would like to see us intervene in terms of coming to some type of, you know, if we have to negotiate some type of settlement with Assad where it's like, okay, don't attack hospitals anymore. I mean, there's a whole range of things that we could be doing that may or may not have that much efficacy in terms of lessening the tragedy for the Syrian civilian population. But it doesn't have the downside of a military intervention. I mean, there's a whole range of those things, without a doubt. So,
yes.
You know,
Thank you for your time, Sam. I just fear that it's based in economics and not in ethics.
It probably is.
Analysis. And thank you so much.
All right, I appreciate the call. I mean, look, you know, I. If you're looking for governments to ever act purely on humanitarian principles, you know, and don't see any type of upside in it for them, just completely altruistic. You know, you're going to have a hard time. That's just what I think. Jay Tingle, on the app, David Gregory is Jewish. Sorry. Long Doggy, your buddy Bill Scher is shilling for Obama's Syria war, trying to start an argument with Alan Grayson on Twitter, who says it's not our problem. As far as I can tell, Grayson is ignoring him. He probably doesn't realize Bill is a big, important contributor to the New York Times. Look, I don't think the answer, and I disagree with Grayson's framing of this. I don't think it's not our problem. Even if you put aside the moral imperatives, I think it's going to be our problem one way or another. I also think, like I say, that we have some moral obligation just because of just the fact that we have amassed such a huge amount of wealth as a country. You know, I believe in the concept of giving back on some level. But just because I believe that, that it is on some level our problem, does not mean that we have the solution. Sometimes you have problems for which there is no solution. And in this case, we may have some sort of mitigating solutions insofar as, like, you know, like I've outlined in terms of the aid and whatnot. But I don't think we have a military solution. And so maybe it's better phrased, like, this is, I don't think the phrasing, it's not our problem, is the right way to phrase it. I think it's just that we don't have the solution. We don't have the answer. And I was saying this about Syria 2 years ago. There are some problems we just can't fix. And until somebody has a rational, logical explanation of how this gets fixed by us, that there's a huge absence of any reason why we should do this. Maybe you should have him on again and have him argue Obama's case and then tell him why he was full of shit. That was fun. Maybe we should. I mean, I wonder what Bill's position is on this, but.
Look, Sam, I could give you the answer on how bombing Syria. First of all, it would reverse climate change, and I'll explain to you how. If you look at.
We're going to extend Keystone XL so that it'll actually.
Fracking opportunities.
We're going to put Keystone XL. The pipeline will actually go right on top of Assad's summer home. Send the bomb through the Keystone XL pipeline. Then we reuse the pipeline to Sandinista. Clinton got Senate approval for Kosovo action in 99. Bombing started a day later. He didn't wait for the House vote. Obama may follow the same path. That he looks like he can't win the House vote. Interesting.
I want to double check that. Yeah. That's interesting.
Grayson did come off as pretty callous on Chris Hayes by saying it's not our problem over and over again. Hayes called that line morally obtuse. By the way, Karen Finney is also against action right now. Yes, but I also disagree with her framing of, like, this is going to weaken Obama. What? I still don't get it.
I think it's really important, though, because I saw Ron Paul the other day talking about, like, the Progressive Libertarian Alliance on foreign policy, and I think there's huge problems because of exactly what you're talking about, because it's all under the envelope of that. Like, a guy like Matt Duss says this is the wrong action for the following reasons, but of course there's a catastrophe there. Of course upholding the value of not using chemical weapons is significant, not just, it's not our business, we don't care, here's a conspiracy.
Look, here's the question. If there was, and this is obviously fantastical, if there was a building in Damascus that they had silly built sort of like out in the outskirts of Damascus, in the middle of an industrial park, okay, where there's no residents around, and there was a problem, the industrial park, there's no other building, it's just one building that's there. And it has all the command and control infrastructure that Assad but only the command and control infrastructure for chemical warfare. This is obviously fantastical. It wouldn't diminish, it wouldn't be weighing in on the side of the rebels, wouldn't be weighing in. All it would do is it would take out their capacity to launch chemical weapons because they foolishly set up a system where you have to go and check out a dongle from that one building, and that dongle fits into everything that fires chemical weapons. Okay, this is completely fantastical. Does that mean that we have the ability to take that out with one Tomahawk missile?
should we fire that missile? That's the question. My answer would be yes.
Of course.
I would be standing on the top of the Empire State Building screaming it out loud if the UN said, we authorize this attack. Okay? But even short of the authorization of the UN, I think my answer in that situation would be yes. Maybe with some reservation, but for the most part, for the sake of this thought experiment, yes. Okay. Now, that's a fantastical situation. Once you start to get into the reality of the thing, it becomes a lot more complicated. But that situation, I set that situation up because it asked the question, okay, it's not our problem. So we shouldn't even, why are we going to spend $1 billion on the Tomahawk missile, whatever it is? I'm not going to lift a finger to do anything about it. That's what you're saying if you say it's not our problem. I'm willing to lift a finger. But it needs to be done in the under the proper auspices, and it needs to be a finger that is not going to go and poke somebody in the eye and have them lose an eye. That's why I think that that construct is not right. Phil on the app, every time you one of you says chemical warfare, I start to sing the song. In my movie recommendation of the week, Atlas Shrugged 2. The recasting is on Netflix. Only watch with alcohol in hand. The entire cast was fired for part 2. It's amazing. Kirby Dillinger. Sam, I find the possibility of a traitor within the Assad regime ordering the gassing in order to attain U.S. involvement in the conflict quite compelling. Perhaps one of the generals who recently defected. Who knows? Noble Baker. Michelle Obama's impression just keeps getting better. Sam's not so much. Oh, Michael's Obama. No, Sam's not so much. That's right. Well, Michael goes home, and this is what he does. He goes home and he practices.
That's all I do.
He's like, I could finish the guest list.
Right.
First or I go. I could practice at this.
And I say it to myself. I was like, all right, what's the plan? How do I get Sam out of the office to use his equipment to record my podcast? And then,
which Michael did again, by the way.
Yeah.
The first question at the Aslan media interview. Do you do an Obama impression? Okay, and the final IM of the week. I always appreciate, Sam, I always appreciate your take on these big issues. On a lighter side, perhaps you and Michael could do an Obama versus Bush debate. It would be hilarious. Maybe someday, ladies and gentlemen. All right, next week, Matt and Mike Monday. We got to figure out what's going on in the future of Matt and Mike Mondays. But as of Monday, it is happening. I'll be back live on Tuesday. They will be here live on Monday. The app coming up next week. We'll hopefully see you soon. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the lie ball. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in.